Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Soul Seekers podcast, where we believe that hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure as we share our mission of mentorship is conservation. To learn more about everything we do, check out our show on Carbon TV or go to soulseekersnation.com. Freedom on, everybody, and stay soulful. Do you love America? Do you love supporting American manufacturing? If the answer is yes, then check out Coltac gear for Made in America products with a lifetime warranty. Coltac manufactures specialty gear designed for long-range shooting, hunting, and other tactical applications. From their support bags, suppressor covers, their new bino harness, and a whole lot more, Coltac is creating tough, durable, and innovative gear for serious shooters. Go to Coltac.com to see all that they have to offer and use the code SOULSEEKERS10 to save 10% at checkout. If you are wanting to become more accurate and deadly with your shooting, one of the best things you can do is upgrade your trigger with a Timney. Timney triggers are 100% made in America and have been since their founding, providing a crisp, reliable, and repeatable trigger break every time. I'll be shooting Timney triggers in my guns this year, and I hope you'll join me in shooting the world's finest trigger. Go to timneytriggers.com to get yours today. If you're looking to take your hunting to another level, there's no better way to do it than by subscribing to Onyx Hunt. If you want to get better at hunting and go deeper into your scouting, Onyx is the number one GPS app for that. Join the millions of hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. If you want to know more about Onyx, go to onyxmaps.com/hunt or download their app today for a free trial. As a school teacher of 20 years, safety has always been a top priority. So when it comes to shooting and hunting, it's no different for me, which is why I always prefer to shoot suppressed. Huxworks Safety Company is a human exposure workshop dedicated to building products that are optimized for the safety and health of their customers without compromising efficiency or performance. If you're not shooting suppressed, what are you waiting for? Go to huxworks.com to start protecting your health and future today. That's huxworx.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Soul Seekers podcast. We're recording live here at the Huxworks Safety Company booth at the Western Hunting and Conservation Expo in Salt Lake City to support the Mule Deer Foundation and everything around that. Today's episode is a beautiful round table, but more like rectangular as we're sitting here.
It's got rounded edges.
Yeah, in the loft of the Huxworks booth. We got Tyler Wilson here from Huxworks sitting to my left, and the men of the hour, the celebrities. I got questions when I said I was podcasting with you boys. I got questions in email form being like, oh, I need to make sure I ask some questions. So, Preston Lentfer.
Lentfer. Dang. What's a Lentfer? That's what I like to say.
Yeah, there you go. Preston and Seth Swerzik from the Hornady podcast. These guys are savages and just amazing people. So we're going to be talking about ballistics, bullets, but also how that corporates and corresponds with suppressors. Because if you're not hunting suppressed, shooting suppressed, you're doing wrong. I mean,
go home.
Yeah, right? Like,
yeah, nobody likes you.
Right.
Everyone's an expert in their own opinion, and I agree with your opinion.
Yeah. I am a huge proponent of suppression, but it's hard to constantly say, you know, you got to be suppressed because I'm all about freedom.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
America.
Yep.
But make your own choices.
It tastes real good. Like, I don't know a whole lot of people that don't like a prime ribeye steak cooked medium rare over fire. Like,
yeah,
if you don't like that, you're probably wrong. It's just, there are people that don't, but you find them so few. It's just like shooting suppressed. Once you do it, man, that's pretty cool. Kind of like to do that.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. How's the show been for you guys?
It's been busy. Like, the traffic here is awesome.
It is pretty cool.
It is really cool. And it's the consumer show. So to see the customers, we don't sell anything here, but there's lines of people just waiting to talk to Seth. And it's just interesting.
Yeah, News 11, this just in, that's not happening. But it is busy. It's a busy show.
Let me pull up this email real quick and I'll
more consumers via email here.
Yeah. Hey,
let's keep this show rolling.
Tyler, you're a quiet guy, man. Don't be afraid to let that voice shine.
How do you guys feel about this show in terms of like how educated the consumers are versus some of the other shows?
There is a different customer base here.
Yeah.
There is no doubt. You know, in the last few years, 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 years, the gear and the development of the gear. I'm talking barrels, bullets, scopes, rangefinders, suppressors, everything, stocks, mapping services. All of that has increased at a dramatic rate, and it outran the education of the average consumer. But then you come to a show like this, and it's very evident that the consumers are now becoming more educated. There's more information out there. There's podcasts, YouTube videos, training classes, and they're willing to go get that training. And when you take, you know, the Western hunting crowd, they're passionate about it. They do it, you know, maybe 10, 20 days a year, but they dream about it the other 340 days out of the year.
Yeah.
Well, and not only are they passionate about it, they live in a place where it's applicable, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
East Coast guys are always saying, well, I'll never take a shot past 200 yards. It's like, okay, so maybe some of the stuff isn't really that applicable to you. Here it really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm actually born and raised in Ohio, so whitetail hunting, bow hunting.
Yeah.
And so, like,
big buck state.
Yeah, big buck state. Yeah, absolutely. I took it for granted. I did not take advantage of that, and I'm so sad about it. But, you know, coming out here, it's these guys are very serious, and those guys are serious too, but there's just so much more you have to do to prepare for a season in terms of physical fitness and shooting and long-range shooting. And I mean, you know, well, I bet you can out-hike a lot of people.
I'm a specimen.
It is down inside me, though, because, you know, you take those traditional big buck Midwestern states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Ohio, Iowa, places like that, and it is a different grind. I mean, there are a lot of people out there that work equally as hard, but in just different places.
Ways.
You know, the physical fitness might not be the thing, and training at altitude's not really a thing, and packing in for a few days. But when you've got, you know, you've got an 80-acre chunk you can hunt, and so does the neighbors, and there's 165-inch buck on there.
Yep. You're competing against that.
Yeah, and the trail cameras and the strategy, and if the wind's blowing from this direction, I can't access this stand here, and there's a lot that goes in.
And they take a week of vacation and sit in the stand all day.
And I tell people, I'm like, it's not that it's not hard. It's a different hard. Like you said, it's a different hard, and it's environment management. Like, you're managing the environment you're hunting in, whereas out here, you kind of got to manage for the fact that you can't do that.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of the difference, is you're going out here on these massive tracts of public land, and so you got to train to be able to take shots that are a little bit longer because you don't know what opportunity you're going to have and what that situation looks like, whereas, like, a Midwestern guy is like, I need to get that buck over here. Like, how do I do that and have a shooting lane and be able to execute what I need to do?
Yep. Yeah, so, I'm friends with the neighbors, but I'll shoot that deer.
So tying it back to the consumer base, what are the type of questions you get at, like, a Dallas Safari Club show versus out here at Western Hunt?
Well, that show's a little bit different in general because
there's more dollars there.
There's more dollars, and those guys are, like, big across the pond type hunters, right?
A lot of dangerous game questions, of course.
Dangerous game questions like, hey, you know, what do you think, 416 Ruger or 375 H&H for this hunt or stuff like that. There are some other, like the NRA show, for an example. That's all like, hey, you know, I'm shooting tops 200 yards. What do you think? Should I run a CX or should I run a SST or stuff like that? But it's focused differently at each show.
The questions that we get here specifically, a lot of them are more technical in nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Like, I've got the gun. I've got the optic. I've got the ammo. How do I know, you know, what my maximum range is? You know, how far is that bullet going to expand? At what velocity? You know, I've got a ballistic calculator. I need help using it because I'm not getting the right data.
Right.
Stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. Man. Well, that's a great question in transfer into talking about suppressed. So, Ty, you've been working for a suppressor company. A lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's
a
ton of fun.
The science that you guys are putting out, and by the way, you guys know that Huxworks Safety Company is actually more than just a suppressor company. The whole idea is that they're mitigating the health risk to the shooter. For the overall experience. And
well, it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Human Exposure Workshop. So that's what Huxworks stands for as a whole. Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. So plug that.
Well, real quick, how many suppressors do you guys own, each of you?
Five?
Mm-hmm. I think I'm at five on the way, fifth one on the way.
Yeah. How about you, Ty?
More than I have guns. Obviously, that's natural. You know,
then
I'm
you
sure
need more guns.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. So I am so I bought Buy Once, Cry Once, man, back in the day, probably like 10 years ago, got my first suppressor and all that. But the problem is I find myself always going back more or less to one suppressor until I found out that I'm like, okay, I'm going to dedicate this can to that weapon and stop switching. Do you guys dedicate cans or?
Not at all.
Do you have a favorite?
Well, excuse me, I have six now that I think about it. But I'm starting to dedicate some because it's just easier. It's just easier. And I run short enough barrels on my rifles, individually or personally I do, that I can store that rifle with the suppressor on it and fit it in my rifle case.
Ah.
So it's not, I don't have to take it off anyway. So, you know, I could drink Diet Coke, but why? Like Mahatma Gandhi once said. So I'll just thread it on there and leave it for the most part. I'm not there quite yet. I have, you know, I still do a bunch of jumping around. But for me personally, I'm in the process of, you know, doing that.
Yeah. Preston, what do you... He's hilarious.
That's a great quote, really. I'd like to see it like cited somehow. I'm not sure we can at this point. No, I'm swapping stuff around all the time. I'm pretty heavily invested into the area 419 system.
Yeah.
So I got taper lock on all of my stuff. Yeah. And I guess at the start of it, I was like, well, if I ever want to put a brake on this, I'll just put the Hellfire brake on it, you know? And now I don't really use brakes anymore. But it's still nice because, I don't know, I feel like they have a repeatable consistency where I can screw them off, screw them back on, and nothing's really going to change at all. I don't really have to worry too much.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. You guys have a lot of different mounting systems, Ty.
Well, we actually don't. We're actually pretty pared down. And to, you know, your point about the 419, they use a taper system. We also use taper systems. There's a few others out there. We're not the only. But I tell people all the time, especially hunters, the taper system is the best suppressor mounting system when it comes to accuracy, repeatability, all of those things. So to your point about that, I tell people all the time, like, a lot of guys want to direct thread things. And there's nothing wrong with that. I hate having exposed barrel crowns and barrel threads and things like that when I'm messing around with guns, especially if it's a hunting rifle that I want it to maintain its accuracy. Mm-hmm. And so I want a device that's going to cover that barrel crown and keep it protected. Worst case scenario, I could replace that and not have to redo my whole setup, right? Taper mounts, we use the same thing on all of our flow line stuff.
What is a taper mount, just for the sake of the listener?
So it's essentially, I mean, it's literally, it's a shoulder, right, that is machined into the muzzle device that allow, and then the same thing is machined into the suppressor, and it allows for an alignment to occur when you actually thread it on. And it also keeps carbon from traveling back into the threads, so that's another benefit as long as you do it in that order. But generally speaking, it's going to center the entire system so that you get a repeatable mounting process every single time you don and doff that suppressor. So it's going to return to where you zeroed it every single time, as opposed to some of the other systems where you have ratchets and different things, and you can create misalignment in different ways, and you could have potential accuracy impacts.
Like angular deflection versus when you've got two surfaces that are already angled, they have to mate perfectly, so it'll just find home. It's kind of like... if you've used a lathe, you know, like there's a lot, a taper, you know, like anything less than, what is it, 7 degrees is like a Morse taper.
A Morse taper.
And it'll lock that thing in there fiddle string tight if you're not careful.
It's funny you say that. That's exactly what we're kind of messing around with.
Right.
The Morse taper. I've got a couple direct thread cans, and they swap from stuff all the time anyway, but it's also, I put on stuff that I would never have a muzzle brake on anyway. But that Morse taper, not Morse taper, but that taper lock, I honestly feel like I could, well, and even some of the guys out there, like, have taken their muzzle, their suppressor off after a stage at a PRS match, every single stage, and shot the match and like, have done
just
really well, just to prove the point.
Yeah.
Yep. That's cool. All right, so yesterday I was giving my bear seminar, and I always get asked all the time, you know, like, what caliber are you shooting for bear? What do you recommend? And we've talked about this before on the podcast. I just love short actions.
Yep.
You know, fun to shoot, easy to stay on target and all that stuff. When it comes to shooting supersonic and suppressed for hunting, what is the caliber that you prefer to shoot or you find that provides the best performance when you're also dealing with that supersonic?
Me personally, I'm a huge 6.5 proponent. And it feels weird because I'm the 7mm guy.
Yeah.
And if a 7mm is required, you know, for, you know, say elk, let's say, well, then, yeah, I'm going to take the 7. They're all going to be suppressed anyway. But, man, I love a short little 6.5 and keep that barrel nice and short, put a tiny little can on there, and call it a day. So I'm a big 6.5 proponent, especially on black bear, which aren't particularly tough to kill anyway. 6.5 will do just fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like you're leading them on a little bit. At the end of the day, we both have one-and-done guns that live in the safe, ready to go all the time,
That's right.
And they're 7 PRC.
Yeah, you said short action.
I did say, yeah, short action. Yeah.
And I have a short action 7 that I could
You
use.
Can't say the name of it.
I can't.
Yeah.
It's a little wildcat.
It's kind of naughty, but.
It's not that naughty.
No,
anyway,
but.
Yeah, I'm a big 6'5 guy.
Yeah.
What about you, Ty? What are, like
6'5 PRC. Yeah, that's what I would do for a short action. And then 7 PRC for a long. So.
Yeah.
Same.
I put on the Flow 7.62 on my 300 PRC, and I took it out to the range, and I was having a lot of fun. I had to get a barrel vise to get that suppressor off of it because it's counter-torqued or whatever, counter-threaded. Each shot is just getting tighter and tighter and tighter.
And I tell guys, like, that's the problem I'd rather have than my can getting launched off a mountain.
Yep.
Yeah, like, people kind of get caught up on that. I'm like, well, you got two choices. You can launch your can downrange, or you can get it off afterwards. You know, you
and
choose.
On a hunt, I know which one I want.
Yep.
Question for you, Tyler. In that vein, we use a lot of anti-seize at Hornady. In fact, I've generally covered in it because if you touch the bottle, it's everywhere.
It's on your face. You look like the Tin Man.
Your wife really likes greasing or anti-seizing your threads?
Yes, and we actually sell. We have a product called Ceramax. So it's a
Johnny
it's
gets some
high-tech
of that.
Grease. Yeah. So you put that on the thread, and it'll kind of prevent that super seize. So, yeah, I recommend that all the time.
Dude.
But, yeah, don't get it on you because you'll never get it off.
Yeah.
Like, that shirt's done.
Yeah.
100%.
I put a coat on in the lab sometimes, just, like, if I'm putting on a new barrel.
A white laboratory coat.
Yeah, and you got to, you know, put it around the mating surface where the lug, or excuse me, where the shoulder meets the action and on threads.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's inevitable. I don't understand. I take it at very delicately. It's ridiculous.
Dude, some of our production guys, we actually use it in some of our processes for the military cans we make. And they have to put it on in a couple different applications. And I always feel bad because they got a tub, you know, they got a tub like this and they have to apply it. And I'm like, every time I'm like, you know, they got to bring a shirt to work that's like the grease shirt. It's just like that thing is toast. Yeah, you're about to get that stuff everywhere.
But a little bit goes a long way, and it does make a world of difference for when you go to take something off and you give her the
old college try.
Yeah, if you're just a regular guy, one tub of that could last you a lifetime.
Dude, we just sell the little, like, 3-ounce squirt bottle. Like, that'll last most people a lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's 100%. Crazy. That's crazy. Well, you guys, can we talk about cans that are potentially on the
way? Yeah, we can talk about development for sure. We just can't get into, like, what it, you know, final form.
Yeah, so HuxWorks has always been flow-through based where it's works really well on AR platforms.
Yeah.
Yep.
What problem is that AR platforms and bolt guns aren't the same. So you got hunters, you got PRS, NRL hunter or shooters, and, you know, why do I want a flow through can on a bolt gun?
Yeah. And that's it's a great question, and we get it all the time.
Is there any advantage or disadvantage?
I wouldn't say there's no disadvantage, right? Okay. Like, there really is no disadvantage. And then obviously the taper mounting system that we use is obviously robust in the same way that the 419 and some others are. And then our cans are robust in general. Like, we talk about, you know, the torque lock. So there's all those things really favor a hunting application. But to the point of the consumer that comes up and asks me that question, they're not wrong in the sense that there are ways to prioritize suppression for a bolt gun. And so we haven't done that. We've always been the destination for gas gun guys. Like, we are flow through. We're the original flow through company. And we still, to this day, you know, maintain the highest flow rate in the industry while still being able to achieve, you know, all the other suppression metrics at a pretty good level. But we have the horsepower, we have the ability to test, we have the end users that we can test on and with, that if we can turn that towards some of the specific problems like a bolt gun or 300 blackout subsonic, right? Like, those are different problems. And so we've been attacking those recently. A lot of you guys may have even seen that out there already with some of our 300 blackout stuff we did with the military. But yeah, so right now we're in the process of doing a lot of development on bolt guns, a lot of around the NRL hunter type of crowd, the PRS crowd, and we're going to come out with a couple of different products in the coming year or so that are going to be pretty exciting, I think.
Are they still going to be flow through?
We're going to do gas management. We're going to use our technology to our advantage in a way that we think we can get higher performance for what a bolt gun guy would want. But it's not going to be your traditional flow through like you see where it exits forward of the muzzle all the time. We're either going to give you an option to deal with that in a different way, or we're going to do some things with that gas that hopefully will give us advantages on sound and other things these guys, you know, prioritize.
Yeah.
So we have a, you know, we're doing our giveaway here, and we're asking a one simple question: what do you prioritize for a hunting suppressor? And there's, you know, I think five answers. It's like price, weight, sound, you know, a couple accuracy, a couple other things. And it's always weight, sound. Most of the guys aren't even saying price, which is always, these guys, I mean, this crowd, to the point earlier, they're very educated. They know what they want. They want stuff they can rely on, you know, so they're spending some money for that stuff. They go get a hunt. They don't want to cheap out and have something fail on them in the field. So weight and sound seem to be the constant thing. So you got to find a way to balance that, because you could go super long, big, heavy, and get great sound. Mm-hmm. And then you could go super tiny and you have terrible sound, but it'd be 4 ounces, right? So you got to find that. What do they want? And so that's the conversation I'm constantly having, you know, with these guys, is what do you want? And then how can I make this product adapt to different environments of what you could do with it? Because if I'm a guy that hunts, but I also do NRL hunter, if I'm serious about it, I probably have two different guns. I'm probably hunting with a 7 PRC, and I'm shooting a Creedmoor for NRL hunter. Right,
probably a 25
or a 25 Creedmoor. There you go. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
if you ask us, and we're just a couple of knuckleheads, I'd throw one in there. It's weight, length, then sound.
100%. I think you're right about that for sure.
And the other part that I was going to add to that was, you mentioned accuracy. I feel like in 2026, that's I wouldn't put that
unspoken,
almost like a non-issue.
Gosh darn better be.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
If it hurts anything, that's a problem. At a minimum, it should do nothing. It should be great. And if it helps me shoot a little better, even better. But I would think this, you know, we've been making suppressors for a while as an industry. The assumption is that it is already accurate.
Yeah.
Weight first, length second, sound suppression third.
Yeah.
So the follow-up question that every listener that hears this podcast is going to say is, does it have a break on the end of it?
We're going to have some options. So we're working on some stuff. And to that point, you know, we've been doing a lot of testing on what's out there. And, you know, when you're putting a brake on a suppressor, I'm not here to say it's not useful, because we have tested. We found there's some use case for it. When you start putting 2-3 ports on the end of a suppressor, you're just adding length, machining, and cost kind of for no reason is what we're finding.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Well, one port, you see that in a muzzle brake by itself.
Yeah, I mean, and that,
those first,
you know,
two
MDT,
ports are doing all
they did
work.
Some really cool stuff. I've seen some of their videos and content around that, and they kind of test adding a port, you know, and seeing what that does. And there is a point where you start to get to, this is diminishing returns, right? And so to that point, when you're doing it on the end of the suppressor is already doing some recoil stuff within managing that gas and things like that. By adding multiple ports to the end of the suppressor, it may look cool, but it's not doing much for you. So,
well,
yes,
looking cool is a big part of it.
You do want to look cool, but you can look cool with a single port too.
To feel good, to shoot good.
Oh, dude, I always say that when I played sports. Right?
Yeah, you got to look good to feel good to play good.
We talked about this. Yeah. We had a wide receiver, Eddie Pertia.
Yeah.
Look good, feel good, play good.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh, he did all three. Sanders.
Yeah,
yeah, he was actually really good. Shout out to Eddie. If you're listening.
Hey, RIP, baby.
No, he's still with us. He's still with us. He's a good guy.
I don't know what he's doing, but man, yeah, that was.
We don't want to devolve too much. We can talk about it later.
Well, so you're saying that, and I know that all my buddies that are shooting PRS, NRL, and that they hunt are going to be like, BS.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, here's the thing. Like, if you get to the pinnacle of anything, right? Like, if you put a Formula One driver in a car, he could tell you, like, the nuance of that car to a degree we would never even realize. So, like, I don't want to discount that. But there is a point of diminishing return where it's, what do you need out of this thing? And that's the question we're asking ourselves, is how do we get the most out of what we're giving them and not adding unnecessary cost or length or weight or different things like that? And so we're in that conversation right now. So we're actually going to be talking to a lot of PRS guys and giving them all these options and getting real feedback and like, hey, look, I know this is what you shoot now. Like, don't just say yes to that because that's what you've been shooting. Literally
shoot it.
Shoot it.
Well,
like,
and
tell
to
me
Tyler's
what you
defense,
think.
It's like there's been a lot of dogma in this industry for eons, right? And we've fought that battle a little bit ourselves, right? So the consumer doesn't know what they don't know. It's our job to educate them.
Yeah.
And you guys over at Hornady do a phenomenal job of education. Your podcast is just absolutely blown up.
Well, it has, but we're working on the education piece. That's the, you know, when we, like our podcast, for example, you say it's blown up. Well, it's gotten popular in our little miniature bubble of the world, right? But I think it's been successful because we're trying to educate. whether that's external ballistics, terminal ballistics, interior ballistics, stuff that is difficult to understand. We've got the team to help break it down. And I think people just like that education piece, whether it's the shooting or the ballistics or how suppressors work or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It, man, I love this talk because that's one of the fun things of being able to have a podcast, right? Like, hey, we're going to sit down and we're going to chew through all this stuff because otherwise I'm going to have to go search out and really dive into it. When it comes to what you are running, Ty, to enter the giveaway, you're like, hey, what is it that you want? But what is it that Tyler wants when it comes to the suppressor on his gun?
For a hunting suppressor?
Yeah.
Is that what we want to talk about? Yeah. I would probably mimic a lot of what these guys, I mean, you know, I am this crowd and, you know, we get along great. So I would agree with a lot of what they're going after. To me, I want reliability. I want simplicity. Like, I don't want a bunch of extra stuff that can fail, you know? And so I don't personally, I want some sort of, you know, Area 419 type of taper mount that is super robust, that I know I'm not going to have like a strange misthread in the field or something weird. And, you know, you think about taking your gun somewhere on a hunt, you got to fly somewhere or drive somewhere and you got to pack it down in a case, or maybe your guy going to Alaska and you got to get on a bush plane or something and you got to take that can on and off and different things. Like, I want things that are super robust, that are simple, that achieve what I need them to achieve and are there when I need them to be there. So that's kind of my approach. I think we all go through this journey. Like, we were talking, you know, everybody builds like a 6-pound rifle at one point, and then they're like, this is the worst idea I've ever had in my life, and I want this thing to go away as fast as possible.
And I paid a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, like, I'm over here shaving every ounce I can, and it's like, dude, I'll cut my toothbrush in half and I'll carry a 10-pound rifle. You know, like, it's fine. I'll figure out other ways. So to that point, like, I want simple, reliable, weight is a priority, and how can I get the most sound suppression that's going to do the job I needed to do in the field out of that package without adding a bunch of length and weight to my system and complexity.
Yeah.
Screw it on. It's zeroed. We're good to go. That's kind of what I would look for.
Well, I would say anyone who is shopping for a suppressor that hunts needs to go with a Torx system.
Yes.
Because I had a suppressor blow off the end of my gun.
Oops.
And went down range, and I was like, you know, and that was $1,300 suppressor. I waited a year and a half to get it. I'm not trying to send it back to the manufacturer in case, you know, anything happened.
And that's embarrassing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, they definitely talk about you when they get it back. I, you know.
Oh.
Like, they won't tell you that, but there's at least a couple. There's at least a couple jokes, right?
So I'm at the gun range, you know, working my shooting, and the last thing I want is to know that my suppressor's loosening up if I'm not constantly checking it.
Yeah.
And then to be on a ridge or a canyon overlooking, trying to shoot cross canyon, and I got a steep drop off below me, and all of a sudden, kaboom, and my can straight just disappears into the wild.
And not only that, you were trying to shoot at an animal that you really wanted to shoot at, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And it's, you didn't get it.
Cheeto. Yeah.
So at that point, I actually just straight took my suppressor off, even though I actually preferred to hunt and shoot suppress. So that was a big moment, and experience will always trump opinion, right? Until you're in the moment, you're like, okay, well, this guy says that, but
this guy's lived it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know it because I've seen it with my own eyes.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
So 338 arc.
Yeah.
Is that where it's at? I mean, what's the difference between 338 arc and 300 blackout?
Well, it's very niche, right? So is that where it's at, if that's what you're looking for? Because its use case is quite small for the civilian side, the commercial side.
But if you're into awesome subsonic cartridges, like, it's the one, right?
The biggest thing with the difference between, like, say, a blackout is you want the terminal performance, so you make a bullet that's going to expand at those velocities, okay? We got the sub-X. We did that. So now it's subsonic. And generally, if you want to increase performance, you know, say more dramatic expansion, longer range performance, what have you, you increase the velocity. You just
crank
it
up.
Yeah, just crank it up. Well, if you're subsonic, there's a limit to how much cranking up you can do, right?
Yeah, it's all got to be 1050.
Yeah, it's got to be under the speed of sound. So the only way
that's science
to increase the performance is to make the bullets heavier, so you increase the energy. And so with a 338 arc compared to a blackout, you have roughly 1.5 times more energy on target than a 300 blackout. It doesn't sound like much until you start killing stuff with each of them, and you can physically see and hear the difference.
Really?
When it gets to the target. Oh, yeah. So that's the big thing with the 338
arc. Not only that, though, like the case is absolutely optimized to have the right amount of powder in it to have really good SDs and ESs.
Mm.
Right? Where we're in some subsonic cartridges, it's a challenge.
Yeah, it's chaos.
It's a challenge, right? So this thing shoots really, really well. Like, I believe the group that really wanted this, the requirement was like 100% impact on a man-sized target at 300 yards, yeah. Or 300 meters.
300 meters.
And it delivers it.
Yeah. And so when you think about shooting long range, well, out to like 500-700 yards, you can get away with murder from a ballistic standpoint and still probably hit what you're aiming at. You can get away with a lot because the bullet's getting there so fast. But when you get to 1,000, 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 yards, if you have a really large velocity spread, that will manifest itself with a large vertical stringing of your shots.
Yeah.
And it'll increase your wind deflection as well. So you have this big vertical stringing at the extended ranges because of the different velocity, the time of flight. Well, when you back down things to subsonic, that manifests itself at distances as close as 100 yards because it's in the air for a second and a half to get there. So velocity spreads when you're trying to have high performance with subsonic cartridges. When you start pushing the boundaries of 200, 250, 300 yards, velocity spreads are king for keeping dispersion low.
Interesting. So I used to reload 300 blackout with 208s.
Yeah.
And I think it was 8 grains of Lul gun.
Okay.
A lot of fun. A lot of fun. So much extra powder was left over.
Yeah.
Just wasn't burning up in my Ruger American. And so question for you, Ty, is I got all that extra powder that's not being burned. What's that doing to my suppressor?
Yeah, I mean, and the whole system probably.
It looks like a cornfield inside your action.
And it's going to get a bunch of unburnt propellant down into the...
Yeah, cornfield that was picked with a John Deere.
It's not ideal.
Are you a Kubota man?
No, I'm a Case IH man. Come on.
He'll fight you right now.
Sorry. Oh, I'm sure Kubota's
Tyler, go ahead.
But yeah, and then even you're using a Ruger American, so that's a bolt gun, right? So you're not introducing as much of the reliability problem, but then you come back around to the gas gun world running that same type of setup. That would crush you. You'd probably have a bunch of issues, failure to go into battery and so forth. We saw a lot of that on a project we did for 300 blackout, and this was kind of a detriment to our flow through. And this is why I brought that up with 300 blackout is we had to redesign our entire suppressor. It needs a little back pressure a lot of times to clear that chamber out. Like we were slow-mo-ing the chamber of a gas gun and watching, you know, some of that unburnt propellant kind of get in the way of what was going on there, and so. Some of that back pressure was actually helping, and so we ended up kind of redesigning the whole thing from the ground up to attack that problem. Not only that, the sound suppression on the subs, we weren't getting there, you know, with a true flow-through design, whereas the high pressure, it lends itself more towards that. It wasn't working for us, so we had to redesign that entirely. Mm. And so bolt guns and you know, the subsonic world from a sound suppression side of it, they kind of cross there where flow through is not the pinnacle of suppression there, and I get that, you know, and that's something we're trying to address.
Oh, interesting. How often do you actually really need to clean a suppressor?
For us, we try to say 2,000 rounds, give it a soak and shoot.
You guys ever cleaned yours?
Look, I saw the cringe.
No, I probably need to really bad.
Yeah,
I've only got one that I would probably realistically need to clean.
Yeah, 22.
No, Thunder Beast Ultra 7. That was my first can in 2000 whatever, and I don't use it, truthfully, very much anymore at all, but it's got the most rounds on it from years of abuse.
Do you guys sell more subsonic to whitetail hunters?
Probably.
I mean,
Texas pigs on a feeder is a big one because you can get that shot off, and they're going to run away, but they don't know where the sound came from, and it's quiet enough that you get kind of a confused look. They spin around. You can usually get a couple pigs down.
You wait and they come back.
Yeah, or you wait and you come back. But yeah, whitetail box blind stuff is a big one.
Yeah. Episode 1 of Soul Seekers Season 6 is going to be dropping here in the spring, and it starts with a hog hunt. And we are shooting suppressed. I wasn't 300 blackout. I think 22 Creed is what we were pushing. And then we had 22 arc and maybe a 6 arc. But we had them where they were running all over and just ended up coming right at us. Like
they're coming right
to us. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. was like, ah, you know,
taking the fort.
Yep. So that was a lot of fun. But to your point is making sure, you know, that bullet is quiet. Man, I love getting on those animals. I love hearing the bullet impact and the delay of subsonic. Yeah. Ooh.
On my next thermal hunt, I might take a subsonic just if they get real close, you know.
Yeah.
I'll have the 22 arc there as well, but maybe take 338 arc.
Yeah.
Question for you, though, on the flow-through stuff. I mean, a lot of that is like the gas not coming back into your eyeball, right?
Yep.
That's a big thing because nobody likes that. And when you got a really bad system, it really stings.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
And adjustable gas blocks never actually do the job as much as you want them to.
And I tell people, you know, that's another one. Like, why would I care? I could just kind of tune my gun. And I'm like, I hate the idea of having my gun rely on what's on the end of it to function, you know, well.
Yeah, right.
Right. So if I can't take my can off and have some confidence this thing will still get the job done, I personally don't like that. So even if you have an adjustable gas block, I tell people, I'm like, what's cool about still doing a flow through design is that you get the full envelope of what that thing provides you instead of putting it on the rev limiter,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, if I got to put my adjustable gas block on the rev limiter to get my gun to function with my can, like, that's a Band-Aid. That's not something that's actually giving me any sort of advantage.
Yeah, right? Medicating the symptoms, not...
And so
not
you go flow cause, through, it's like, now I can really fine-tune this thing. Maybe I have a little bit more parameter I could play with, and it's like I could get this thing exactly where I want it, and maybe that changes based off of maybe an ammo change or something like that. And I could go back to, let's tune this, get it where I want it, and then I know I always have a reliable system.
Yeah. I talked to you about this yesterday, but I'm going to repeat it for the podcast, is I'm going out west, I'm hunting black bear, I'm trying to decide, do I want to go with a solid copper bullet or an ELDX or something like that?
I'm interested in this one, too.
How do you go about determining what bullet you're going to choose?
You take this one.
Okay. Well, there's certainly a lot of... conflicting information, and there's a lot of personal preference because they both work really, really well. The biggest difference, though, and just for a moment of clarity, our solid bullet, the CX bullet, is not pure copper. It's an alloy of copper and zinc at about a 95 to 5% ratio. So it's not as sticky as pure copper. It doesn't foul your barrel quite as bad. It's easier to manufacture for us. So it's not pure copper. But anyways, bullets work because of velocity. So that's the first place to start. When I say a bullet works, a bullet expands and transfers energy. So to make a bullet work, it needs velocity. Well, a CX bullet, being a little more rugged, needs about 2,000 feet per second to make it expand to caliber and a half diameter. And that's our threshold for minimum expansion. Gotcha. We want caliber and a half. So it's got to be 2,000 feet per second or more. Where an ELDX, those things will expand to caliber and a half down to 1,600 feet per second.
Mm.
So if you're shooting a real slippery bullet, long ogive, you know, bullet at a good velocity, you have a much longer terminal performance window from a range standpoint. So the first thing would be look at where you're hunting realistically and to be honest with yourself about what is your maximum shot distance with your rifle, how much you've trained, and the terrain you're going to be in. That'd be the first one, is where you're going and with the parameters that you have, does that bullet impact with enough velocity to make it work? Because if it doesn't with a CX, then the option is, right, you know, you go to the ELDX. The other thing would be, like, say on a black bear, you know, the goal on a black bear is not to shoot it in the shoulder because the vitals sit right in the darn middle, right? You're shooting them in the ribs, so you're shooting them in some soft tissue. So if you need to break a shoulder down, like you're going on an elk hunt, especially in the timber, or just elk in general because they're tough, you want to plant that bullet squarely on the shoulder. And a monolithic bullet will retain so much more weight. You know, our CX bullet is generally 95 to 99% weight retention.
Wow.
And we give it down to 95 just to be, I don't know, forgiving.
Yeah.
But it's almost always
typically it's a grain less because the tip weighs a grain.
Wow.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Because
three grains.
And your CX come with a polymer tip.
Yep.
Yep.
So... The weight retention is huge, where an ELDX, depending on where the distance you shoot it and the impact velocity, it'll be somewhere between 50 and 80%, depending on, like I said, the impact velocity. So if you got to punch a shoulder, man, a monolithic bullet really hits above its weight class. Raking shots, where if you get a quartering away and you come into the last rib, it'll likely come out the front shoulder. Those bullets really penetrate well. So that's where I like to look at what's your realistic shot range and distance. What's the impact velocity? And are you shooting shoulders? Because that will definitely lean you to a CX. And then the other thing is, which one shoots better? Because animals are killed with shot placement.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bullet performance is much a second fiddle to shot placement. So that's where I draw the line. That's how I do it, Preston.
No, I agree with you. I will say a little caveat. Not all CXs are 2,000 feet per second.
That's true.
We got a couple that are, like, meant for, like, the 300 blackout, right?
Yeah. Lever
it's,
guns.
It's barely starting above, you know, 2,000 feet per second. So yeah. That one's down to, like, 1,600, I think, 110 grain CX. Some of the monoflex bullets, obviously, those are being coughed out of the muzzle in those lever guns, so they have a lower minimum expansion velocity. But, yeah, you need to be realistic with yourself. Is there a chance that I'm going to stumble upon an elk and he's at 40 yards in the dark timber? Or is this terrain open and I'm really going to need to airmail one? Mm. Not airmail. That's a bad
one. No, I mean, yeah.
And then the next question I always tell people is, are you capable of engaging at that range?
Right.
Because have a real conversation with yourself about that. Yep. Make sure that that's a real shot.
So if you're shooting on whitetail properties and you're worried about fence lines and close quarters, you're not shooting a copper?
No, I'm shooting lead core bullet in the high shoulder. I'm going to drop them in his tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whitetail are not also particularly tough to kill, and I have shot many through the shoulder with lead core bullets, ELDX specifically. They do a good job.
So a lot of the concern for the general consumer is going to be like, well, why is my copper bullet so much lighter? Why do I, you know, for 22 Creed, for example, you guys came out with the 80 grain ELDM, ELDX, but then it's a 65 grain 22 Creed CX bullet. And it's like, I don't know, is 65 grain a big enough bullet to be able to do the job?
Yeah, and it's a simple science. Physics? Geometry? I don't know.
It's tricking science.
Copper weighs less than lead, right?
So for the same significantly
for the same bullet shape, like the 65 grain CX, for example, is kind of modeled after the 75 grain ELD, no, 80 grain ELD X and ELD match. So it's about the same shape, almost the same length. It just happens to weigh 15 grains lighter because it doesn't have any lead in it.
So
but they punch above their weight class, right? Because they retain all that weight.
Yeah.
So people get hung up on that. We just had a guy in the booth yesterday. He said, oh, is 190 the heaviest you go in 30 cal? And I'm like, well, yeah. Oh, I need a 215. I said, well, you're going to have a 6 twist in your barrel? Because if you string that copper bullet and make it heavier, it's going to have to become longer, and then you're going to need a faster twist to stabilize it. So it's kind of a math thing, and it just weighs less than lead.
Yeah.
Yeah, not as dense.
You got any other bullet questions? We're kind of on a time wrap, so we're going to have to wrap this up here pretty soon.
I do not specifically, but this is all. Another thing, too, is the copper is meant for a shorter, like you just said, 2,000 feet per second, so 65 grain. You're going to probably engage that target a little closer.
Yeah, 400 yards and in probably.
Yeah, that's a different equation versus what, well, so that's and, part of it, too.
And we've got a handful of bullets now that are modeled after some really sexy match bullets right now, so 22 cal's got it, 6 mil's got it, 6.5's got it, 25's got it,
7 mil.
7's got it, 30's got it. So the ranges aren't as short as you might think. You should really, get on Hornady Ford off and see where that thing runs out at 2,000 feet per second. It might surprise you because on a 300 PRC with a 190, in most elevations, I don't think 600 yards is out of the question.
Nah, gotcha. Yeah.
Hey, that's a good one. Like, I think that's a good way to kind of do the research, know what you can shoot, and then know what your equipment's designed for.
Education.
And just have that in there. Like, just know that. Hey, I'm this guy here with my capability at range, and where does my equipment fit within that, and am I covered? And if you're doing those two things, you're way ahead of most people.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this, and what Tyler just said, and, you're on the range and you're testing yourself, right? Remember, you're on the range, okay? It's not the heat of the moment. It's not in the middle of battle.
Yeah.
You're not judging wind, trying to get a shot off real quick. Remember that your cone of dispersion on the range is going to be a little bit different
than
game time.
Down angle off the side of a mountain somewhere trying to figure out how to get in a good shooting position.
And that's a great leading question for next. So I get a lot of questions when I'm talking at the range about sighting in. And in the Hornady app, you guys have the angle of sight in.
Zero angle.
Just break that down a little bit for the listeners who are like, what is zero angle versus I'm on a range and it's flat straight out in front of me at 100 yards?
I'll let you do this one, then I'll synopsize it.
Okay, synopsize it. Yeah, yeah. He's a philosophizer. Yeah. Okay, so you go to the range, you shoot, say, a 5-shot group at 100 yards, and you adjust your scope such that the point of aim is your point of impact at 100 yards. That's a very simple definition of zero range. Okay, well, in reality, let's say hypothetically, it's perfect. The center of that group is the exactly where you're aiming at exactly 100 yards. Well, that range of 100 yards is an arbitrary number based on the environment that you're shooting in. Mm. Because the environment will have an impact on the drag of the bullet. And the wind speed and direction will also have an impact on the drag of the bullet and where the bullet lands on that target. So let's say you're here at 4,100 feet above sea level. It's 50 degrees and the wind's coming right to left at 5 miles an hour. And you have a perfect 100-yard zero. Well, as soon as you go to 1,800 feet and the wind's coming from the other direction, you are no longer zeroed at 100. It might be 107. It might be 94. You know, it's small, but it is there.
But it makes
a
difference.
And it exists. And it can matter when you start shooting long range. So what zero angle is you do everything the same, just like you would a zero range. But you tell FORDOF, you tell the calculator, the environment in which you are shooting. It captures that environment, and then you tell the calculator where your bullets landed relative to your point of aim. Calculator does all the math. It's a big iterative process, and it says, if these bullets landed here, we know the drag of the bullet. FORDOF knows the drag. We know the bullet shape. We know the wind conditions and the environmental conditions. There is no way that those bullets landed with the mean point of impact right there unless the barrel was pointed at this angle relative to your line of sight through the scope. So your barrel's pointed up, you're looking through the scope. The angle captured there, that's a physical angle. Now the computer knows that angle and it knows the environment. Mm. So when you go to a totally new environment, you know, you go around the world, that zero angle is still accurate as long as you open FORDOF and update the environment. Because now it knows if that's the environment that it took to produce this result, I can change the environment to anything I want, and it still knows the angle.
Yeah.
So it's not as advanced as you might think, but it's that math. That's why, you know, you look at the military, that's why they can drop JDAMs through the window of a building from 30 miles away is knowing this math.
Mm.
Is the angle of departure and exactly how that bullet flies in its environment because it's dynamic.
Two things, all right? Number one. Anytime you do a zero, you should probably do it with more shots than you think you need.
Okay?
Number one, I'm a 20-shot zero kind of guy anymore. If I'm taking this particular rifle very seriously and I know that like I may be stretching the legs on this and it's not a 400-yard gun, 20 shots is my minimum. Obviously, do what you're comfortable with. If you've always done 5, jump it up to 10. Like just incrementally do it, and you'll get a better zero overall. Number two, to simplify what Seth kind of said, I'll do a little bit of a story, right? I'm in Grand Island, Nebraska at the Grand Island Rifle Club, right? It's 28 for pressure, unadjusted pressure. I've got 28 inches of mercury. It's 50 degrees, and I'm at 1,800 feet. If I zeroed the rifle at 1,000 yards, okay, and I called it good, that rifle zeroed, and I'm going to hit dead impact at 1,000 yards. Do you think that if I went to 5,000 feet and 23 inches of mercury, that it's also going to be zeroed at 1,000 yards?
No.
No, probably not. But if you were to use a zero angle and tell FORDOF, hey, this was my wind when I zeroed at 1,000 yards, this was the inches of mercury, it would know how to adjust for when you went to 5,000 feet and 23 inches of mercury, you wouldn't be zeroed at 1,000 yards anymore, right?
Yeah.
Your zero is probably more like 1,250 or 1,300.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of a story way of explaining zero angle.
There you go. Last question real quick, wrap up. Speaking of FORDOF, Loophole just came out with the new BX6 range-finding binos using Hornady FORDOF. One of the biggest issues I've always had with range-finding binos is that the glass was just not that good. You guys have used them in the field. FORDOF is awesome. Talk a little bit about it.
regardless of Fordoff being in there, glass is awesome.
Yeah, we live in a different world now. Like, when we started in this industry, you know, everybody had a PST Gen 1, you know, that was the big rage. We've come a long ways in terms of glass quality at this point. And I agree with you said with old range-finding binoculars maybe not being on the upper echelon of glass. We're there.
Yeah, their glass quality is amazing. Edge-to-edge clarity is amazing. The low light is amazing. The other feature sets outside of Fordoff, they freaking nailed it. You can drop a pin to
on
Onyx.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, the big part is there's a lot of companies that can do that already. It's the accuracy in which they do it. Because if you drop a pin at 1,000 yards and you're margin of error is 100 yards.
Yeah, you can have 1,000. A completely different problem when you show
up.
That's,
a problem. Their accuracy is less than 2.
That's crazy.
2 yards.
No, 2%.
So 2%.
Yeah,
okay,
1,000 yards.
20 yards.
If you blindly walk to that point, you're within 10 yards of any direction of where that thing's going to be. And the difference between 10 and 50 in one direction, when you're in a juniper bed looking for a down mule deer,
is huge. Yeah.
So that's cool. But the Fordoff integration is fantastic. It's simple. It's easy to use. They've done a great job integrating it with their control app. And it really is one of just a fantastic tool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Ty, when can consumers be prepared to experience the future cans that you were talking about earlier on?
We're a year, maybe a little bit more. And I think hopefully summerish for one of them.
This summer.
Somewhere in the summer, 2026? Early fall. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's our goal.
Sweet. So. Guys, thanks for being here. Thanks
Absolutely.
For kicking off
thanks
a Sunday morning
us.
With us here at Huxworks. If you like this episode, give it a thumbs up, share, leave a rating, review. Remember that mentorship is conservation, and you can never outgive good. Be blessed. For Tyler, Preston, Seth, and myself, freedom on, everybody, and stay soulful.
If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to support the show, you can always like, share, subscribe, and leave a rating as it helps us share our mission of mentorship is conservation. Thank you so much for tuning in and being a part of Soul Seekers Nation as we transform lives through primal adventure.